Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Finance Committee. I'm Frank Hornstein, Chair. And we have a couple of items to do today. This is our last in our series of informational hearings. We're going to start hearing bills next week. And I chose a couple topics today. We spent a lot of time on transit yesterday, and of course there's some road issues that we want to deal with, road and bridge issues as well. Members, the State Transportation Improvement Program is really the cornerstone of one of the most important things that MnDOT does and that we need to examine as a legislature. We have a lot of people that we went around and we gave, when we did introductions, had different corridors that they were interested in having funded. And this STIP program is really the guidebook, if you will, for how MnDOT goes about funding these corridors and interchanges and other items that are of critical importance to the state's infrastructure. So we're going to spend some time with that. The second part of the hearing, we're going to discuss the MnDOT's bridge program under Chapter 152, the bill that was passed in 2008. We set aside significant resources for bridge improvement and rehabilitation and new construction. And as I mentioned yesterday at the hearing, the bridges were all the conversation, as they should have been after August of 2007, after the 35W disaster. But we haven't heard much lately, and I have some concerns about where we are at in the bridge fund and the bridge program, and so we're going to talk about that. So we don't have a quorum yet, so we won't have a motion to approve minutes, but we still want to get our hearing started. So welcome, and if you could identify yourself for the record, and sure. We'll get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Gieske, and I'm the Director of the Office of Capital Programs and Performance Measures at MnDOT. And thank you for having me here today. I'm looking forward to discussing this one question today, and that is, how do we select projects at MnDOT? So the next 26 slides, I hope, will illuminate that a little bit for you. And as mentioned, we do put our program into the State Transportation Improvement Program. Looks like this year. Plan contains over 2,000 projects. It covers a four-year time span. So that means about every year we select about 500 new projects as we complete the old ones. So I want to talk about how do we go about selecting those 500 projects. Project selection at MnDOT, we call that process programming. So if you hear me use the term programming or even just looking at the cover of the term program, that is all about project selection. But in order to understand how we do programming, we got to start at the beginning of the process, which begins with the planning process. And planning begins with a vision. You probably are familiar with the Minnesota GO vision. It's a 50-year vision, and it's based on understanding that transportation is a means to an end. It's not the end in itself. Infrastructure is one of many elements that contributes to the high quality of life, competitive economy, and the environment, and it answers the question, what are we trying to achieve? It does not say what we're going to do or how we're going to do it, but what is it we want to achieve? It casts a visual image of what the world would look like if we achieved our mission. So following the Minnesota GO vision, we have the statewide multimodal transportation plan. This plan articulates policies and strategies to support the vision. It provides direction to all of the modal and system plans, including the highway system plan. But this statewide multimodal transportation plan still does not identify projects. It's just identifying policies and strategies. So for highways, the next step after that is the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan. We call that MNCHIP. You may also hear it referred to as the 20-year highway plan. That's all referring to the same document. MNCHIP uses the vision and the strategies that were created in the statewide multimodal transportation plan and turns those into highway-specific strategies. So this is where we get started talking about highways. MNCHIP provides the performance measures, the performance goals, the needs analysis, the revenue assumptions, and system priorities necessary to select the individual projects. Midship does now actually conclude with a 10-year program, 4 years 4 years in the STIP, which we just talked about, another 6-year work program, and it also identifies spending priorities for the following 10 years. We update the plan every 4 years, but the STIP and the work plan are updated every year until the next planning cycle. So that's the quick overview of those documents. The Minnesota 50-year vision is available on the website if you want to know more about that than I covered today. Also, the statewide multimodal transportation plan is available on the website at the sites that are in your handout. Going a little bit further with the Minnesota GO 20-year State Highway Investment Plan, or MINSHIP, that also has a website where you can find more detail than I'm going to give you today. But the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan addresses the future of the nearly 12,000-mile state trunk highway system. It focuses only on the state-owned highways. It doesn't include the local highways because this is the state highway investment plan. And the plan, as far as programming goes, answers six questions for us. The first question it answers is, what would we like to invest in? These can be considered the needs. How much do we need for pavements? How much do we need for bridges? Or safety, for example. How much do we need to meet the desired conditions that we want to achieve that were identified in the vision and in the statewide multimodal plan policies that were adopted before? Next question is, what resources do we have to invest? This is our revenue. We estimate the revenue that we expect to receive from all the revenue sources that we use for highways for the 20-year period. The plan is fiscally constrained, so that means that this revenue estimate limits what we can do. The next question it answers is, how did we decide what to invest in? This is our process. We don't have enough money, don't have enough revenue to satisfy all the needs, so how are we going to decide which needs to fund? The MINSHIP plan will lay out the process for how we're going to decide that, and we'll be covering that in a little more detail in a couple slides later. The next question it answers is, what will our investments be? Those are our priorities. The result of the process is an investment priority, what needs we will fund, and at what level. So, for example, we might say we're going to spend 30% of our funds on pavements, or we're going to spend 25% on bridges. That is an investment priority.
Question, just 1 minute.
Sure.
Thank you. On the issue of pavements, it seems like we always have a little moving number in terms of, you know, what's the life cycle of the pavement? You know, is it 7 years? Is it 10 years? Where's MnDOT now in terms of that? You know, you talked about the 50-year planning process. So, you know, are we just paving roads and then, you know, another 7 years, you know, just putting a small amount of blacktop and then going after that? Where's the agency at in terms of that, you know, criteria or?
Mr. Chair, a new pavement is usually designed for 20 years or more. If it's not a new pavement and they are doing some kind of rehab or an overlay, it could be a short time, maybe as short as 7 years or maybe more like 15 years. It depends upon the condition of the highway and how long it needs to last and what revenue we have available.
Okay. And then, on a similar question, one of the reasons I'm concerned about this is that, you know, MnDOT did this excellent pavement study, which I think indicated that in 10 years or under, we're looking at somewhere upwards of 2,000 miles of, you know, pavement that would need to be replaced. So how does that fit? Is that separate or part of the STIP process? When you're looking at improving those particular stretches of problematic pavement, where does that fit into the plan?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the results of our pavement management system or the other infrastructure, the bridge management system, does come into the programming process, and I'll be covering that
okay.
a little bit later and show exactly
okay.
where
Good.
Those come in.
All right, thank you. That's great.
Okay. The next question that we expect MNCHIP to answer for us is, what will the results be? So after we've determined our spending priorities, we want to know, what are the outcomes? What will we get for that investment? So an outcome would be something like, our pavements will be less than 9% poor, or we will have continued reduction in fatal accidents. Those are outcome statements, and that's what the plan tries to answer for us. And the last question we have is, what won't we be able to invest in? We know our revenue, we know what we can invest in, so we also can tell what we won't be able to do, and that's the gap. It's the difference between what we can invest in and accomplish and what we need to invest in. That's the unmet need or the gap. Process for determining our investment priorities and answering those questions includes a lot of analysis of performance data, including the results of asset management systems like the pavement management system, which we'll continue to talk about. But the process that we used goes far beyond that, far beyond just the engineering review and technical data. There was an extensive effort to involve the public in this decision, including other governmental agencies, local governments, stakeholders, advocacy groups, individual citizens were all invited to participate. This past year, MnDOT engaged in a more robust public involvement process than we have used in the past, and we used these methods that you see here on this screen. We engaged the public in several meetings, personally face-to-face meetings around the state, gave them the opportunity to kind of sit in MnDOT's chair and make the decisions that we often have to make. Ask them, what do you truly value in highways? What are your investment goals? How would you make the decision to invest more in some things? What would you invest less in? And we asked them those questions and got their answers. Another public outreach form we used was the online interactive scenario tool, which was available on the website from October to mid-November. This very closely resembled what we did in the face-to-face meetings. We got 913 people to come to that website, and of those, about half completed the whole process and recommended a scenario for how they would spend the funds. We presented the public three scenarios when we went out, both online and in person. They could select one of those scenarios if they liked it, or they could design their own and tell us how they would change it. We presented the same information to groups of MnDOT leaders to get their opinions. And when that was all done, we combined all of that input, all of that analysis together, and created our investment priorities. So this is kind of the end of the planning process, but the result that you see here. The chart represents the investment goals by asset category, which is how we split them up, bridges, pavement, safety, and so on. And again, MnSHIP is only about state trunk highways, so if you look at the little pie chart, if that were all the money that was in the STIP, some of it goes to local governments, the rest goes to state governments, so the big pie chart only represents what's in the state share. But this is the result. For example, one of our investment priorities is spending 34% of the revenue on pavement projects. And hoping to achieve an outcome of 9% average poor at the end of the plan period. It's the outcomes that we're after. The percentages are just kind of a guide for us in programming. How many projects should we select? How much money should we spend? But it's really the outcome that we're trying to achieve. So that brings us now to the programming process itself. This is where we are now settling down to actually select projects. And again, just a reminder, the end product of this whole process is the STIP. It's required by federal transportation laws. It's updated annually. It contains 4 years of projects, and it can be amended in between those annual updates if need be. So we'll start with step one. The first step in selecting projects is to define the programs. Because of MAP 21, we had to redesign our program structure a bit this year. Which would be another long presentation. So for today, I'm just going to say that we restructured it in a way so that we could do well under MAP 21 and that we could still provide resources to all the traditional stakeholders who have been involved in the federal program before. The first program is the statewide managed programs. It's about $408 million. This predominantly includes investments on the national highway system. The national highway system is a federal system of highways that includes the interstates, the freeways, the major roads that connect the major population centers. These investments need to be managed at more of a statewide level because of the requirements of MAP 21. We need to pick very specific projects and have specific outcomes because of MAP 21. So that's why these are managed at the statewide level. The second program is the district managed program. It covers all the other investments that aren't in the first group, all the other state highway investments. These investments are more heavily influenced by regional concerns, so the programming decisions for these happen in the districts more predominantly rather than in the central office or the specialty offices as with the statewide program. And then the last group is the Area Transportation Partnership Managed Programs. These are mainly for local roads. Most of the money goes to local governments or local projects and is managed through each district by the Area Transportation Partnership, which we'll talk about those a little later too. Second step is to create the investment guidance. And in order to do that, we start with these investment priorities that we saw just a moment ago. That comes from the planning process. And from those, we create very specific instructions for the districts and the specialty offices on how much they should invest and what the outcomes should be so that they know what targets they're shooting for. We give them dollar amounts. We tell them which programs, what the programs are, how many dollars are in each program. And we give the Area Transportation Partnerships instructions on how the money should be spent. In order to do that, then, for them to continue the process, we need to distribute the resources amongst the various districts. Resources are divided up among the 8 districts by program. Money in the statewide program is distributed by need, and by need I'm referring to, and we went back to the first part of the presentation where we looked at the pavement management systems, we looked at the performance data, and figured out how much money was needed in order to meet our outcomes. And that's the amount of money then that goes into this program, and then it's divided up by where those needs exist. The second distribution, the district managed program, is distributed by a formula. We have used formulas for a number of years to distribute money to the districts. It's a similar type of formula. That looks at factors like system size and amounts of traffic and distributes the money based on that basis. And then the Area Transportation Partnership, that other smaller slice of the pie, their programs are distributed by population, that was defined in Map 21. We use the same population definitions to distribute this program, and by program eligibility. Some programs are only able to be used in the metro area, for example. So now we have reached the point where now we're actually ready to pick projects. Picking the projects in these three areas, the statewide and the district managed programs have a similar process. So I'm going to talk about the two of those together, but one at a time here. The statewide program begins with the statewide specialist, so the pavement engineer, the bridge engineer, and people in their office. They will use the pavement management system and the data that we have in that and other data that's available to them, and they will recommend a pool of projects and give that recommendation to the district. So it's not necessarily a complete list, or it's probably more than a complete list, and there's some flexibility for them to change that, but it gives them a starting point for projects to look at. The next step then is to give that information to the districts. And they review the recommendations, and they are the ones who create then the list of projects. They may take projects directly from the list. They may modify them a little bit based on some local conditions, or maybe they'll even have suggestions for a substitute project that may be equally as good as the one that was on the list, but for some reason of scheduling or other factors, they might want to substitute a different project. And when that's done, the end result is that the districts and the specialty offices kind of combine their energies, and they agree on a list of projects that meets the outcomes that were put out in the plan, satisfies the priorities of the districts as best as it can, and so they agree then on a single program. The district programs start at the district, and that's really kind of the difference between the two. The district candidate projects select their own candidate projects. They use the same kind of information that's available to them on pavement condition and performance measures, but there's usually a lot of other factors that affect these. These are the smaller highways, and so there's local considerations and other regional issues that they need to consider when selecting those projects. then they consult with the specialists in the central office, the pavement engineers and the bridge engineers, and they get their input on that program. And then they go through one extra step, and that all the 8 districts then combine their programs together into a single all-district program. And the extra step involves getting together, looking at the risks that each one was able to satisfy with the projects they selected, and kind of balancing that out a little bit. And then at the end, again, they still meet together, and everybody agrees in common on one program, combine it with the statewide programs and the district programs, and that produces then our final slate of programs that goes into the STIP for MnDOT. The Area Transportation Partnership Program, that gets handled a little differently, and it also requires, I think, just a little bit of background on some of the other players that are involved here. The Area Transportation Partnerships, we abbreviate ATPs. I'm sure you've heard that term many times before. The ATPs are a little different than some of the other acronyms that we use, the MPOs and the RDCs. I'm going to talk about those too and explain who they are and what role each one has. But there are 8 ATPs. Each one is aligned with a MnDOT district. The ATP's role is to help MnDOT integrate local and state priorities within their region, and it is one of the methods that Minnesota uses to meet the federal requirements for public input on the creation of the STIP. ATPs are not an agency. They are a representation of many local agencies that come together and form this committee, this partnership that assists MnDOT with their programming. Again, there are 8 of them, and they align with the MnDOT districts following the county lines, so no county is in more than one ATP. Membership on the ATP has members representing the regional governments and transportation providers and stakeholders in that region. The membership of each ATP was determined when they were formed by the MnDOT district engineer consulting with the MPOs and the RDCs in the areas, and the membership varies from district to district because they have different local interests, they have different constituencies, different stakeholders, so they're not all the same. They choose from which local interests are present in their district. This is just a summary of where they get their members. It's a total of all of them, so you can see cities are represented, counties, townships, modal agencies, bus transit providers, and so on. The Regional Development Commissions, that's the RDCs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, or the MPOs. MnDOT has representatives on the ATP, our tribal representatives, and then some others. The ATP process has been customized in each district to reflect the needs and the issues of that area. It plays an important role in forming the regional programs. MnDOT's ATPs have these functions in common, the ones you see on the slide here. They do customize their process, but for the most part, they all have these common attributes. They include soliciting for federal aid local projects. They rank in those projects, and then they integrate those projects into the other project lists that exist in the district. The ATPs then recommend to the district engineer the final product for what should be in their program. The money that goes to the ATP managed program is distributed by a formula, as we mentioned, based on population and eligibility, and then this is how that ends up being broken out by each district. Now, just to clarify what the roles of the other groups are, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, or the MPOs. MPOs were created by federal law. They exist in areas with a population of more than 50,000. There are now 8 in Minnesota, and that's just a coincidence that there's 8 MPOs and 8 ATPs. That's not, they're not related. MPOs have responsibility to perform transportation planning in their areas. They create an area transportation improvement plan, and their plan and the MnDOT plan need to agree when it goes into the STIP. Planning they do is very similar to the planning that I described when we do MnSHIP. They do the same kind of planning within their region. The one thing that's different about one of the ATPs and MPOs in the metropolitan area, the Met Council is the MPO. They also double as the ATP, so there's really only one in the metro area. Regional Development Commissions, that's what RDC stands for. They are established by state law. They perform planning services for MnDOT and local agencies in rural areas of the state. The state is divided up into 12 areas, but only 9 of those have a currently active RDC. Where there is no RDC, there are other methods for providing the planning, and MnDOT may in some cases do the transportation planning where there's no RDC. So getting back to the process now, we've selected projects for all three programs, the statewide program, the district program, and the ATP managed program. Now it's time for the last step, which is to put it all together into the STIP. Each district and ATP submit their combined regional four-year program, and we put that into the STIP. As I mentioned, that's federally required. It includes federally funded projects on both the state and local system. And it also includes all the state-funded projects on the state system. So it's not all the transportation projects in the state, just those. So many other local projects would not be in here if they're only locally funded. This last slide is a timeline of the whole process. There's a lot of information on that slide, so I won't try to walk through the process. Just point out that this is an annual cycle. It begins in November with developing the investment guidance. It concludes in about October with approval of the STIP by the FHWA. Today, where we're at right now here in mid-February, we are in the midst of the time period where the districts are putting their projects together. So they're going through that data, talking to their stakeholders, deciding which projects are candidates, and trying to select the ones that they'll submit to us. And those will be submitted to the central office for analysis and publication in April 15th. Then there's a process after that for public review before the final STIP is published. This is my name and contact information. If you have any other questions that I could answer, as well as a website too for this process if you'd like to read more about it.
Thank you very much. That's a very helpful presentation. We have some questions already for Representative Bernardi.
Thank you. And is it Mr. Giesecke?
Giesecke, yep.
Giesecke, okay. I want to ask a question regarding your investments in the state-required transportation plan for bicycling and pedestrian. How does that show up in, where are those investments plans showing up in your in your actual plan, your STIP?
They do show up in the STIP. I was going to jump back to an earlier slide here. Mr. Chair, this slide is the investment guidance that comes out of MnSTIP. And if you look closely at the segments of the pie chart here, you'll see that there are segments for bicycle infrastructure and pedestrian infrastructure. As we were going through the planning process, we identified these as investment categories that we wanted to make an investment in, and so we created these and investment goals and outcomes associated with each one of those. So now that we're at the point in the process where districts are selecting projects, this guidance has gone out to them, and about 2% of their investments are expected to support bicycles, and 3% are expected to support pedestrian projects, which may be separate projects that would actually show up as a separate line in the STIP, or they may be embedded in other projects. They don't show up separately, but they're in there somewhere.
Follow up, Representative Bernard.
Yes, thank you. So I'll follow up to that. Do you actually have an investment plan for bikes and pedestrian, bikes, bicycle transportation and pedestrian, as you do other investment plans?
Mr. Chair, we don't have at this time a specific investment plan. The planning process for those, I think, is still in progress. That would be the goal, to have equal plans for those.
And thank you. And I still don't think I have your name right, so I'm going to, if you can help me with it.
Giesecke.
Giesecke, yep. Okay. Yep. You said it's in progress. Can you provide me some more detail about when that investment plan will be done and what progress is being made on it?
That I'm not sure on myself. There may be some here who can answer that, or I could get that information for you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question regarding the coordination between some of these districts.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like?
Excuse me.
Yes. You had a. I'm sorry. There was an answer coming. Excuse me. We'll.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Mark Nelson, Director of the Office of Statewide Multimodal Planning at MnDOT. We recently completed a statewide bicycle planning study, which is a preliminary work where we're looking at developing recommendations for a plan, and the next step, which will start this spring, is the development of a district-level bicycle system plan. So we'll have those for each of the districts here probably within 12 to 15 months.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Will that also include the metropolitan area in the plan, as we also have trunk highways in the metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd have to look back and look at that. I know that Met Council plays a large role in bicycle planning within the metro area, so our role in relation to them on that is something I'd have to check in on and get back to you.
Okay, and then one follow-up question.
Sure.
It's somewhat related because it's regarding the American Disabilities with ACTS requirements. I know MnDOT has, a transition plan. How do you have those costs identified in the plan, and is there a good plan for getting up to code on our requirements for ADA?
Mr. Chair, MnDOT has a transition plan for completing the requirements for ADA. They are identified separately in our records, so we will be able to track which investments and how much. They may or may not show up as a separate project, kind of like bicycles, because often it's incorporated into another project. But the investments are being tracked separately, even if they're not listed in the STIP, so that information would be available.
Thank you. And now, sorry, I was a little too anxious to get to your question, I think, but you have the floor now, Representative.
Thank you. You're so kind, Chair. Thank you. My question has to do with the relationship between the ATPs. I serve quite a bit of Wright County, which borders the Metro District and District 3. And there are several projects that I've been made aware of that are difficult to move forward because a perceived, anyway, lack of coordination between the Metro District and District 3. That would be the Highway 55 corridor, the Highway 12 corridor, I-94. There's several sections of it that haven't quite made it into the District 3, so District 3 can deal with it. And so they're kind of waiting for these projects to be finished so they can continue on. Can you just speak to the relationship, especially between the metro districts, and there's four other districts surrounding the metro district they have to coordinate with. Can you tell me about can you just speak to that about the coordination?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, yes, the districts would probably be the ones who would be most responsible for having that communication across the boundaries. The ATPs are there to advise the district, so they wouldn't independently do that, but the expectation would be that the districts would communicate about projects that needed to cross over from one district to another and coordinate those improvements.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Philip. So I should be talking to our district engineers to say, because we've asked these questions as to why it's taken 20 years to finish these projects, so that it's best for them to continue to pursue a relationship with the Metro District to try to get these projects completed through to their district? Is that what we should be doing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would say that those kind of questions are best addressed to the district that has jurisdiction over the highway. If they're interested in improvement outside of their district, they would want to work with their district to work with the district next door.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering about revisiting governance and priorities. When I look at you've got a 10-year investment priorities, but then the district programs are distributed by formula. Does that formula ever change? Does it change every 10 years based on investment priorities?
Good question. Representative Giese, or Mr. Giese.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the formula changes from time to time. In the past, it hasn't changed very frequently, but we have changed it now this year because of the changes of MAP 21. It was necessary to introduce a new formula. The formula usually goes into effect for the new year of the STIP as it's added and doesn't affect the first 3 years because we update it every year. And so the changes would be reflected usually every year in the fourth year of the STIP if we made a change to the formula.
And then, Mr. Chair, the other issue when I look at the various slides, so we have statewide managed program, district managed program, area transportation partnership, a metropolitan planning organization, regional development commissions. I suppose it's sort of a follow up to Representative O'Neill's question. Do you ever revisit the number of organizational structures, governance, to see does it still make sense? I mean, it seems to me the more structures you get, the less the coordination between those various decision makers.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
members
Giese.
Of the committee. The existence of those organizations comes either with the federal or the state laws, so it's not something we can just not have. But the Area Transportation Partnership was really meant to be a place to bring all of those interests together so that we can have, number one, common look at our transportation priorities in a region. So it includes those agencies as well as just other stakeholders that have an interest.
So I heard we have that many structures because sometimes we're required because of federal money. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, Ms. Greer, the MPOs are required by the federal law. The RDCs were set up by the state law, and they're not required to have one because there are three areas that don't have one. But they exist to support the local agencies and MnDOT with planning services. So, because MnDOT doesn't plan off our trunk highway system, so that's where those other plans get done.
Thank you. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any lists of projects that are on your various categories here, the 4-year, the 6-year, the 10-year, the 20-year, 50-year? Are there any lists that say we're going to do this in the next four years, and here's what it's going to cost, and here's what the money is that we've got to do this, and here's what we need to do this, and then we move to the next phase of this, and what you've got programmed there, and how much money you're going to spend, and how much you need, or is that stuck somewhere in one of the circular groups you've got going here?
Mr. Giese.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have lists in different time periods. From years 1 to year 4, the list is this document. This is the list of all the projects that are funded and how much money there is for each one. In years 5 through 10, that's what we call the work plan. It's the next 6 years. There is a list generated every year of projects that are not definitely known that they're going to be programmed, but they're budgeted for. So there's a cost estimate, and specific projects are listed. For the most part, there's some set-aside categories for smaller things that are you just can't envision that far out. But so there is a list, and that list is updated every year. Beyond the 10 years, there is no list of exact projects. There's only general investment priorities, such as what you see on the screen right at the moment. In Minship, though, there will also be a list of what we would do if there were more revenue. It follows what the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee used and put out. So there is a list of illustrative projects, things that we would do if we had more money. It's not a plan or a program. It's just a listing of projects that are like what we would do if we had that money.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in trying to figure out what we should be doing in raising money and so forth for road improvements and top overs for those that like to do a scrape off and replant some asphalt, it would be nice if we would know those and be here talking about them. There were not too many years ago we used to see those lists. We used to know what the plan was, for completing, and as I understand it, your four-year plan is already planned, programmed, and paid for. Am I correct there?
Yes, sir. That's correct to the extent that the funding, federal funding and state funding are appropriated, yes.
Well, I suppose, Mr. Chairman, it's always important that you have the money appropriated to get the job done, but you could at least let us know what you have planned. I don't think anybody in this room knows it, except maybe a couple of people sitting in the audience. And I don't know why we can't get that information from you guys out here to talk about. So when can we get that information? The next time we have a meeting? I might have a meeting next week. I'd be happy to entertain at least a four-year plan and look at that. And you could have the next six-year plan in your pocket with what you plan and how much you've got coming in to do that and how much money you need to do those projects. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, we have the four-year plan now available. We could provide the list in whatever format you like. We have the 10-year work plan. The most recent one is from about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago maybe. We're in the process of making the new one, but we can certainly provide the old one and then the new one as soon as it's in and make that available.
Mr. Chairman, I know you're planning on doing something, finishing something by next fall. That's too late for us. We got to have that stuff now, even if it's only a strong estimate, I would say. And the other thing is, we don't need that big book for each one of us to look at. We need this on a couple of pages.
Spreadsheet.
That's all.
Well, Mr. Giesky, you're getting some feedback, which is helpful. Good thing.
Thank you.
So thank you, Representative Earhart. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll repeat one of the lines that got a kind of bigger laugh the other day is that if I get one more study, since January I have a stack of studies about 4 feet deep high in my office. I'm really contemplating the jump out the window kind of strategy on the studies. So please,
studies are driving me crazy.
Well, it's either that or I'm going to throw them all out the window and probably get arrested. But I really do appreciate Representative Earhart's comments about we don't need another inch. I think that was almost 2 inches thick spreadsheet or two sheets with a line listing of them all. That's not actually my question, though. I'm going back to slide 25, Regional Development Commissions. I have a couple of questions. What three areas by number on your map there don't have one? And do you know if, I mean, in your last bullet point, you have economic development and land use planning. Who's doing the economic development? Is it EDM? Is it a regional economic development authority? Is it people at the Department of Transportation? So really two questions. What are the three areas that don't have one, and who's doing the economic development planning? And we're going to get
Mr. Nelson is our expert on RDCs.
Mr. Nelson.
Can we get back to the slide with the map? We have to the first question, what are the three without? I'm going to wait till we get to the map, and I can point them out. But it's essentially the area west of St. Cloud. There's a region. Most of our District 6, which is the Rochester area, so southeastern Minnesota, and then an area around, I guess, based out of Alexandria.
Mr. Chair, why don't we wait till we get the map up, because you've got a couple of different spaces that have absolutely no relationship to Rochester or St. Cloud. I can't figure them out on this particular map that is on panel 25.
We're having some technical difficulties.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
I would actually just like the number. I mean, you have a 1 through 10.
Right.
And 7W and 7E. And
right.
So which ones are they?
It's 7W10 and 4. And 4, actually, the role of the RDC from our standpoint for transportation planning is being conducted by the West Central Initiative, which is not an RDC, but a foundation. So they're serving that role for us. I also would like to make the point, if I could, that the RDCs, from our perspective, we're using their planners as an extension of us. The role of their Regional Development Commission is not really significant in this. Right. So their planner is working for MnDOT and serving us as a kind of an extension. So in terms of economic development, who's doing the economic development in those areas? Each RDC is a little bit different. Most of them have a role in economic development, but I'd have to get back to you with more detail on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
My real question is not the role that they play in economic development, but who, because as I look at this slide, it looks like it's a group of local people in the area, number 5 or number 8 or number 10 or whatever, and you say here you have an economic development person, people, group on this active planning group to help you, to assist you in where you're going to put the transportation needs of that area. So my question is it EDM? Is it the local economic development authority? And you can get back to me on that. I'm okay with that.
Right.
But it just makes, you know, I have driven through areas and seen transportation pieces put in there, and I look at it with an economic development hat, and I think there either was a complete breakdown of the system or someone was just really stupid. I'd like to kind of know who to blame, so to speak.
Sure.
And I have a question for, you know, that particular person. So that's actually where I'm trying to get to, because it doesn't look like sometimes you, and I don't think it, you know, you're engineers. I mean, transportation division is engineers and construction people. You know, think that way. So I'd like to know who it is that's thinking about that and, you know, planning that particular off ramp from the freeway or the bridge or whatever.
Well, if it's Mr. Chair, Representative, if you could give us specific information, we can provide you information on how that project was selected and what the role of that project was.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm not asking about that particular project. This is a statewide, and unfortunately I'm stuck being a state representative, not just a local representative. You know, so I'm trying to figure out statewide, because we have limited dollars, as Representative Earhart was talking about. We need to figure out where we're spending our dollars. And you need to figure out where the best use of that dollars for, you know, the business community or the school or the college or whatever it is that's going to use that, where they're going to go, you know, and what's part of that plan. So why would you put into a 10-year plan that that off-ramp there and have nothing planned there? So it's not your fault. It's the people who are planning in these particular regions and then sending that information on to you. So that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out. And if it's somebody from, you know, the Economic Development Association of Minnesota should be on these, then that's something we should address. I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm trying to figure out how to make it better.
Thank you. This committee's had their Wheaties this morning. So
yes, that's
right. I haven't had questions. That's why. No, okay. I have Representative Bernardi and Representative Benson. Is there anyone else? And Representative Hausman. And after Representative Hausman, that will transition into the bridge presentation. Representative Bernardi.
So, Mr. Gieske, this is a little bit following the line of questioning that Representative O'Neill started and Hausman and Chair Earhart around responsibilities and the different layers of planning. And I want to bring this more to a practical level, because it was talked about the coordination. Coordination is super important if we want to invest our dollars wisely and be good stewards of our money. In addition to that is also where does the accountability lie, where it is, so that there's transparency and clear understanding. And it gets difficult when there's these different layers involved. So bring it to a practical level. What I'm wondering is, who is responsible for the multimodal system planning? So the different modes, whether it's just all the modes, including, as people will expect, bicycle transportation planning and pedestrian planning. Who is responsible for the plans and the investments in our trunk highways in the metro area?
Mr. Gieske or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the metro area, the Metropolitan Council does the required planning within the metro area. MnDOT also does a state highway plan, and we work together with them to make sure that we're coming to the same conclusions on the state highways. The multimodal plan, which is at a higher level than the highway plan that my office does, MnDOT does a statewide multimodal plan that is done in Mr. Nelson's office. And he coordinates also closely with the Met Council.
So, Mr. Chair, who is ultimately responsible for having those system plans done and incorporated into our investment plans in the metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if it's on a state trunk highway, we would ultimately be responsible. It would be our responsibility to coordinate with the Met Council and make sure that their views were addressed or incorporated into the plan. If it's off the state trunk highway system, then it would not be our responsibility. It would be a combination of the Met Council and the local entity that owns the road.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'll go on record to say that I've gotten a lot of attention from MnDOT this week, and I'm very pleased with that. And actually, Chairman Earhart's questions brought more questions, I suppose, I could have thought of when you folks were in the office. But the fact is, I want to think strategically in terms of, I've seen the books, I like the books, in terms of laying out, your plan for 1 to 4 years and beyond. I'd want to think, I'm a state rep, but I know we all have interests locally, be they economic and transportation. But I would like to see something, when we're thinking about planning, that not only lays out the 1 to 4 years and how we're financing and how that fits into the economic development, but when I think of Highway 52, I would like to see something from planning purposes that says the state has recognized the economic development necessity of the area, be it Rochester or Duluth. And if I look at Highway 52 from a need to raise that to an express level or limited access or whatever you call it, what does that plan look like over the stretched out period? I know, we had the Rochester piece fixed. We're going to be looking at Cannon Falls next and eliminating the stoplights and so on. But in the same vein, in Representative Earhart, I want to look strategically out 20 years maybe and know that the state has seen the districts, there's a couple districts that lie in there, the real need to finish a project and what that looks like. Even maybe an overlay of, like, here's the first 4 years, here's the next 6 years or whatever. So when we're talking about how we're going to finance things, I see how this all fits to an end game that makes sense for the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that corridor look, looking at a corridor and what's in the corridor, recently we initiated a new process called the Corridor Investment Management Strategy, which is supposed to do exactly that. It takes a look at individual corridors like 52, works together with the local agencies and stakeholders, and tries to produce a practical vision for what that corridor can be. What is fundable? What is what will actually address the needs on the corridor? Those don't appear directly in the state highway investment plan. The needs that would show up though on that corridor would be in the plan. So because it's new, it's not something we've incorporated at this point into MnSHIP. But that is something that is new and in development. They've just gone through an initial cycle and are planning to continue that process more regularly.
Quick follow-up.
But sure, Representative.
I know that in time to have all that information necessary to finish what we need to by May, but certainly before we reconvene this next year, I would like to stay in touch, and I can do that through District 6 in Rochester, but with you folks, and just seeing how that is progressing, so that next year when we come back together, I know it won't be a budget year, but at least we can begin to understand how the state's going to invest long-term over those corridors. And that's the way we begin to address major projects like that.
Okay, thanks. And then our last question for this segment is from Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up on Representative Bernardi's question, because it sounded as though the Met Council has a bigger role than they do, because there is a metro district of MnDOT that operates very much like all the other MnDOT districts. Correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
And so, I mean, I almost thought the answer made it sound as though Met Council was sort of in charge, but really, in terms of MnDOT planning, there is a metro district that operates just like every other district.
Yes, that's correct.
And then, Mr. Chair, what I'm hearing around the table, there is a common theme, and it gets back to the question of 10-year investment priorities, and then that question of economic development, or maybe economic impact, and the confusion we have about some of these what seem to be major corridors that sort of never get done. And it strikes me that another level of conversation that might be helpful at some point is, to what extent does somebody sit somewhere and say, when you come up with the investment priorities, it's in our best interest to keep this entire state economically healthy, and how does that factor into the issue of investment priorities and keeping things on track and actually finishing something?
Well, thank you, Representative Haslam. As usual, you've nailed it. I mean, I think that's a good note to end on, because it's something I've thought a lot about, and of course this has come up in our conversations I've had with everybody individually when they've talked about issues in their corridors, and some of you have even brought people from your districts to meet with me, and that's been incredibly helpful. And so I'm in conversation with MnDOT, and we're going to have a committee conversation about this, where we try to address this issue, Representative Houseman, where these corridors that are really important, that seem to come up year after year, that aren't in the STIP but have, you know, economic development and commercial implications. How do we? The fact of the matter is, nothing seems to get done, and how do we start to move that? And so I'm thinking about this, and I hope that we'll even have a bill to hear related to that later this session. So. Stay tuned, but that's a very good note to end on, because that's exactly one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation today. And, you know, and we have two members at Highway 14, for example, Representative Petersburg and Representative Johnson. It's important to them, and I know Representative O'Neill's talked about 94, and we've got a lot of different corridors that have traditionally not been in the STIP. And so where do they fit in? And so that, you know, becomes, I think, an important question. So thank you for that. And thank you. This is a great conversation. I didn't expect we'd have this much interest, but I'm very pleased with it. And thank you for fielding our questions. And again, as is always the case, we have our staff person's name and email and phone number here on page 14. So if anything comes up, please, I'm assuming you can call Mr. Gieske and continue the conversation. So as we're transitioning to the bridge section here, we do have minutes from, we have a quorum, and we have minutes from our meeting yesterday. So I don't know, Representative Bernardi, if you had a chance to.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move those minutes.
Okay. All those in favor of approving the minutes of February 20th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. And so for our last half hour or so, we're going to take a closer look at the MnDOT Bridge program. Like the STIP, it's, you know, incredibly important, important to this committee's deliberations. And we've had a lot of activity on bridges over the last 4 years. And so I want to get an update on that and where things stand with the MnDOT Bridge program. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Strabicki. You can call me Tom.
Okay.
I head up the construction and maintenance section of the MnDOT Bridge Office. And in that role, I am involved in bridge component fabrication, bridge construction, and then also the operations and maintenance side of bridge as well. And I'm here today representing our state bridge engineer, Nancy Dobenberger, who had a prior commitment with an ASHTO committee meeting. So I'll be giving you an update on Chapter 152, and then also talk a little bit about ongoing bridge investment needs after that 10-year period.
Thank you.
And address any other questions you've got about how we invest in and manage our bridges. So as most of you know, Chapter 152 targeted the repair and replacement of fracture-critical and structurally deficient bridges on the system. And I always need to offer up a definition of those terms when I present. Fracture-critical is a bridge that does not have redundancy in its members. So if a fracture occurs on one of its primary members, it can't shed that load to another member, and the bridge could partially or completely collapse. And then structurally deficient, as some of you may know, is a term used to describe a bridge that's in it's got one of its major components in poor condition. And that's a federal term that comes out of the FHWA. Doesn't mean that bridge is unsafe, but it certainly means that a structurally deficient bridge needs some attention and potentially a repair or a replacement. So as you know, Chapter 152 was a 10-year program. We are, at the end of this construction season, we will be 5 years or halfway through the program. There were just a little over $2 billion in state bonds that were made available to help with these repairs and replacements. And the legislation specifically targeted 172 bridges, and those bridges were identified by bridge number. These were actual specific bridges that were targeted within the legislation. And I can give you an update on where we're at in addressing the needs of those bridges. We immediately realized that two of the bridges on the list were privately owned, and one of the bridges did not carry state trunk highway traffic, and that's a bridge that's actually closed to traffic right now. So those needs did not need to be addressed. 27 of the bridges of those 172 needed only routine maintenance during this 10-year period. They were bridges that were designed and constructed with modern materials and methods, and did not have needs within the next 10 years. And so we felt that replacing these bridges within that time frame would be removing them from the system before we had realized their full design life and their full useful service. So this gets into the bridges now that we did address. 76 bridges as of today are complete. They've been either repaired or replaced. And as you can see by the graphic here, that's 44% of the Chapter 152 program. And then looking forward to this year's construction season, we're expecting to complete 13 more, or another 8% of the program. So if you total up the percentages on the right-hand side of the screen there, that's 70% of the bridges that have been addressed. And as I mentioned, we're halfway through the program at the end of this construction season. So we're feeling like we've made some good progress, especially in the early years of the program. Technical glitch here.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just a really quick question. Just for my, I'm a mother, and so I think about these things probably too much. I've actually used to live in a place where there were very, very long bridges, like the Chesapeake Bay Bridge and so on. So the ones that were actually fracture critical, have all of those now been repaired, replaced, something?
I've got a graphic, Mr. Chair, I've got a graphic that shows that the count of fracture critical bridges on the system a little later in the presentation. There are some that will remain on the system. And if I can defer until we get to that slide.
Thank you. And Representative O'Neill, you know, after 35W, I think we all think about that, and it's definitely okay. So we're all thinking that in that frame. So that's why this is so important. Okay, Mr. Strieke, You can continue unless your screen is frozen.
The screen is frozen, but I can go on.
Okay, we have the slides too before you. I think we're under we're on page 2, and I think you're just starting to talk about the major bridges. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that was just a, Mr. Chair, a graphic to show you some of the bridges that you might recognize that were notable or major. Some bridges that may be in your district. The first bridges I'll pop up on the screen here are, have been replaced, or the replacements are underway. Some of these are pretty visible, Hastings and Lafayette, for instance, here in the metro area. And then including our St. Croix River crossing, which is currently in design for the main spans, but we are under contract to get the foundations built in the river this summer. And then I wanted just to include some notable bridges looking forward here that will be addressed in the last 5 years of the program. And you may recognize some of these as well. And when I get to our fracture critical graphic, you'll recognize that some of these bridges that are fracture critical that are remaining on the system are historically eligible or are actually on the National Register. And so we're committed by federal law to actually maintain those bridges and preserve them to the extent we can. So looking at the accomplishments or how we did with this program, you can see by year the number of fracture critical bridges on the state highway system. And you'll obviously notice that the trend is sharply downward and has been over the last 15 years or more. And to address the representative's question regarding those bridges remaining on the system, you can see at the end of the program there will be 52 fracture critical bridges still in service. 10 of those are scheduled for to be addressed in the next 10 years after Chapter 152. There are, I believe, close to 10 that are historic bridges or historically eligible bridges that will remain in service, and we'll preserve those to the extent we can based on the federal laws. And then the remainder are bridges that again, are low risk. They may be fracture critical, but they were designed, detailed, and constructed with modern materials and methods that they don't pose a significant risk of collapse or partial collapse. And so, again, to remove those bridges from service would be to take them off the system before they had realized their full design life. An example of that might be the Cedar Avenue bridges on Highway 77 in Bloomington. Built in the 1980s. Those are twin-tied arches. They're fracture critical, but yet there's no reduction in service life. There's no corrosion. There's no defects that would lead us to believe that there's any significant risk of fracture of any of those bridges, or those two bridges. The other graphic I've got looks at the structurally deficient bridges. And again, this is the second focus of the 152 legislation. And you can see by year the percentage of our state bridges that are in poor or structurally deficient condition. And you'll see that we're projecting over the course of the Chapter 152 years to realize our 2% performance target. And this investment really did kind of turn the curve on those bridges. We were trending in the wrong direction prior to Chapter 152, and with this funding, we're able to meet those targets, or that target.
Are you taking questions now, Mr.?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Chairman Earhart.
Thank you. I'm curious about how much the, I don't know how much the St. Croix Bridge is going to cost Minnesota, but is it cutting into our ability to do the other bridges here, or had you programmed for that 20 years ago?
Mr. Chair, yeah, that we programmed for that more like 50 years ago with St. Croix. That one has been on the books for a long time. Several years ago, and I don't know the exact date, we got some funding through what we call the Statewide Bridge Preservation Program, and it took federal money that was coming into MnDOT and off the top put a bit of it aside for these major bridges like St. Croix that were sort of what we call budget buster bridges, that really a district like Metro or any of the outstate districts, if they needed to fund a major project like that, it would take essentially all of their bridge funding for that one project. So this was sort of a supplemental source of funding that we set aside to bring in to help deliver projects like St. Croix.
So the answer then, Mr. Chairman, is that it's not impairing the 152 construction program.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's it's not pulling from other bridge needs.
Thank you.
Okay, although, thank you, and then I don't want to skip too far ahead, but maybe we'll get to this on page six, because there's some concerning graphics there in terms of available money, but we'll get into that. And so, I think there's probably a correlation between, the fact that whether it's not the Stillwater Bridge specifically, but, you've made incredible progress. I mean, when you think of all the bridges that have been done in 4 years, Hastings and Winona and Dresbach, collectively those have served, I think, to drain this fund to what I would consider to be a very concerning level. But, we maybe will just put off that conversation till you get to page six, but I am anxious to get there because that's an important piece of your presentation. So,
sure.
Proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
We have one question, excuse me. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a previous slide, but to understand it a little bit better, you have a slide where it shows the various projects and dates for some of the ones that are like 2014 and 2018. Are those by then numbers, dates, in terms of they'll be completed or the project started? Can you? I'm interested in two bridges. The Lafayette Bridge, what date is that supposed to be done? And maybe it's on the sign and I miss it. And then the Wabasha over Mississippi Bridge, the Highway 63. Information about both of those.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The Wabasha Bridge, actually, the high truss at Wabasha is not part of the program. That was a bridge that was constructed in the 1980s. Again, with modern design and materials, and is considered a low risk in terms of fracture criticality. The other bridge you mentioned, Lafayette, from my knowledge, is going to be completed at the not well. If we don't want to use the term lucky, but if we're fortunate in terms of weather and delays, I think substantial completion by the end of 2014. But probably more likely spilling into the spring of 2015 for Lafayette.
Just follow up.
Sure, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, back to the Wabasha Bridge in terms of it's on the list and it's 2018 on your slide, even though it's modern construction built in the 1980s. No, I'm sorry, maybe that's Red Wing. I'm sorry, Red Wing, Mississippi 63. So that is a by then?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the dates, those are fiscal years listed, and that's having the project let for construction by that date.
Okay. That answers that. So those dates, Mr. Chairman, those dates are just getting started, not necessarily getting finished.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, proceed, please. We're on page five, it seems to me. Yes.
In a flip forward, looking at ongoing investment needs, I thought this was a helpful graphic to look at our population of state bridges and their ages. This shows the decade of construction and then the number of bridges that fall into each of those decades. And I think the takeaway here, what is interesting to note, is that in the interstate era, 1960s and into the 70s, there's quite a spike in bridge building and continued expansion of the system into the 80s. And those are bridges that were at that time designed for a 50 or 60 year design life. In the 80s, we started targeting more 75 years of design life, and certainly now we're looking at bridges that will go up to 100 years. But when you look at that population of bridges, you know that there's ongoing investment needs beyond the Chapter 152 program. And in addressing those needs, I thought it was important to note that it's not all done through capital investment in these improvement programs and in major investments in rehab and replacement. There's also relatively minor investments in bridge preservation that help us extend the life of these bridges. So just to give you an understanding of how we manage these bridges, of course, the first part is knowing what we have and what condition it is, and that's our condition assessment, bridge safety inspections. That generates the data to help us manage our bridges. And then, of course, the preservation program, actual bridge maintenance, and extending the service life of bridges through cyclical and preventive activities, and, of course, also reacting to repairs that need immediate attention on bridges. And then, of course, the improvement program, which is what we're talking about, Chapter 152 and other bridge investments as well. Mm-hmm. And just to give you a frame of reference, the assessment program is about a $5 million annual expenditure by MnDOT in terms of labor, equipment, and materials, everything that goes into that. Preservation, bridge maintenance, that's roughly a $10 million program in terms of the staff and, again, the equipment and materials we use to maintain and preserve our bridges. And then...
Before you get into the slide, we have a question from Lieutenant Colonel Howe. And congratulations, by the way, on your accomplishment.
And I'm actually going to use some of that experience to get into this plateau of mine. And being a transportation officer in the Guard, I've traveled a lot of roadways and crossed a lot of bridges in my time, and some of them very questionable. But what I've noted in that is that a lot of the bridges that I've crossed actually have nameplates on them where they're constructed in the 19th century. And, you know, you've used that term current construction techniques. Well, if they were built in the 19th century, were they just that overbuilt, or were they that well maintained, or how come we have to replace all of our current, what I'd say, more modern bridges as opposed to those bridges that were built in the 19th century and still handling over width, oversized, overweight travel?
Mr. Chair, there are certainly bridges that are old that there's obviously Roman viaducts that are centuries old. But I think what I'm referring to more is these steel bridges, which is a lot of what was targeted in the Chapter 152 program. The metallurgy in steel has changed quite a bit now in the fabrication methods. We know more about steel fatigue. We know more about fracture mechanics and things like that. And I think it's sort of that era of bridges that that now we know a lot more in the design, the construction, and the fabrication we've improved greatly on that. The bridges you're probably referring to are maybe more of the old concrete or arch bridges, and some of those are almost eternal if they're not exposed to a heavy chloride diet.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, to follow up on that. So I'm going back to a return on investment type process, and if those are almost eternal, why don't we go back to that technique? So when we do it right the first time. We've got an eternal payback on those things, and we only spend the money once instead of constantly having to re-spend those frugal tax dollars, in my viewpoint, to go back and revisit those again and again.
Mr. Chair, I fully agree with that, and I think I mentioned earlier we're targeting now a 100-year design life. Certainly... anything beyond that is it's hard to, of course, measure because we won't be here in 100 years. I won't, at least. I certainly couldn't agree more. And just to illustrate some of the things we're doing on our major bridges like Hastings or Lafayette, we're using stainless steel in our bridge deck reinforcing. A lot of bridge deterioration comes from the deck itself, that it's exposed to a heavy chloride load. That's the first thing that goes on the bridge, and then other things fail. The stainless essentially is eternal, that will be in that deck forever and will not corrode. So that's just an illustration of some of the things we're doing, targeting very much what you're looking for, is a bridge that we invest in once. But don't forget that we do need to maintain that bridge as well. We need to flush our decks and seal our cracks along the way, and that's part of reaching that eternal design life.
Thank you. So our last slide, which I think is a very important one, on the bridge construction program costs. You can go through this, but I do have a couple questions about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot to say. This just illustrates the nature of transportation funding, I think, and bridge funding, of course. You can see that the funding level is up and down. Since I joined the bridge office in 2000, we had the, under the Ventura administration, we had a, I believe what they called interregional corridor and bottleneck investment strategy, and so some money came into transportation. Bridge building spiked up. That might have been a little bit before the O3 bar. We had the Pawlenty-Mulnau bonding program that came in, and we had some additional money come into bridges, and you can see that kind of spike up a little bit. And of course, Chapter 152, we had some federal money come in through the ARRA or stimulus projects. And so you can see the uneven nature of the funding over the years, but certainly the needs we can identify, and I could plot that on the graph as well. And so looking at the next 20-year investment period, we're looking from a bridge need standpoint of about $120 million annually to address those bridges that are from the interstate era, you know, that are now aging into a condition where they need some investment.
Okay, thank you. I was interested in that number. And 2015, 2016, that's concerning to me. It doesn't seem to leave us with a lot of resources to address the, going back to the original graphic of the remaining fracture critical and structurally deficient bridges. So what's the cause of this drop from 2014 to 2015 and 16?
Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, this is bridge construction cost that's shown on here, and this does include Chapter 152 and non-Chapter 152 funds that are put into bridges. So it's everything. The reason I stopped at 2016 is that's the end of the STIP, and so that these are bridges we have programmed that I could go to an actual cost estimate.
Okay.
And put it in here. I suspect that some of those cost estimates are a little bit low, which those bars probably don't reflect what the true costs are of those projects. We haven't gotten to the level of engineering where we maybe know the full scope of those bridge replacements. And I think it's just by the way the data is presented, you can see we've got right in the middle of the Chapter 152 program a year of $350 million. A year of $300 million, and then right in between is a down year. I think that's just the way the lettings have played out with some of these major bridge projects, that we'll have a couple of big ones go and the bar spikes up.
So thank you for that. When you say, well, there's a $120 million annual need that's not being addressed, so what's the gap between the resources and the available resources and the need? Is there any kind of graphic that you have that illustrates that?
Through the MINSHIP or the 20-year investment program, I think we've kind of addressed that. And I know I don't want to extend this longer than it has to be, but there's full bridge needs as identified through just looking at bridge condition and our sort of risk-based approach at looking at bridges. And then there's reduced investment levels that, you know it's a a risk management exercise. You know, investing fully in those bridge needs is maybe not where we need to be. Maybe we can reach a point where we're possibly over investing in bridges. And I'm fumbling a little bit here, but let's just say we're reaching a case where we have zero structurally deficient bridges on the system. That's indicating that we're replacing bridges before their time. That we're taking bridges off. By setting that performance target of 2% structurally deficient, and we have other performance bands elsewhere in condition, but by investing to the point where we've essentially removed every structurally deficient bridge from the system, I would suggest that we're over-investing in bridges. We're over-managing that risk.
Interesting. Okay, we have two questions, and then we'll be adjourning. Representative, was it Bernardi?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and then Representative O'Neill.
Okay, and thank you, Tom, for letting me call you Tom. I appreciate that. My question is about this. bridges oftentimes connect communities, but they also can be huge barriers to communities. How are you involved, and how is MnDOT involved in context-sensitive solutions, environmental justice communities, Civil Rights Act, and engaging the community? And I know MnDOT has a Hear Every Voice. How is that integrated in this so that we get the best bridge, because it's going to last a long, long time? So it actually connects communities and plans for the safety of all modes of transportation.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we as a bridge office, don't sort of lead the projects. It's generally a district project manager that's involved in the context-sensitive solutions in that, but we certainly participate fully in that. We've got a portion of bridge costs that we'll dedicate to bridge aesthetics. We, of course, participate in pedestrian facilities on bridges and are involved in that effort as well. But the bridge office itself is more of a technical resource to the district program managers and project managers. So we don't necessarily lead that effort, but we participate in those efforts.
Thank you. And then our last question of the day belongs to Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Just kind of a follow-up to what I started to ask before. I kind of just crunched some numbers, because I'm kind of a numbers person, and maybe I'm not understanding exactly what you mean by fracture critical. You had mentioned something like they could fall down, and that sort of caught my attention, so that's a bad thing. So, you know, since the program started, it looked like we were at 69 bridges that were fracture critical, and now in 2012 we're down to 63, which is a change of six. Six fracture critical bridges have been addressed with this funding, correct? And I'm confused as to, and I realized that you had said 30 of them don't need to be replaced because you've gone through the measures and they're structurally sound. So that still leaves like 33 that are not. Can you speak to those 33 that are still in this category, fracture critical, that are not in the 30 that you took out, and yet you replaced 70 other bridges, or repaired them, replaced them, whatever, now they're open? So I'm just confused as to why there's still 30 unaddressed that are fracture critical, and 70 other bridges have been repaired and open.
Mr. Chair, that 70 bridges includes also the structurally deficient bridges as well. So that would the bulk of those were structurally deficient bridges that were repaired or replaced. I think the easiest way to address this would be if I could send you the link to the Chapter 152 report that has a bridge by bridge summary of bridges in the system, fracture critical, and I could certainly condense that down into a one sheeter if that would be helpful. That would line by line tell you what bridges have been addressed, what bridges will not be addressed in this time frame, and reasons why. Mr. Chair, if that would be helpful.
I think that would be helpful, because just, you know, we want to make sure that our bridges are not going to fall down. And so if you put them into a category called fracture critical and say these could fall down, but we have, you know, 63 still up and going, 30 you took out because of other measures, but that still leaves 33 fracture critical bridges. I can't go back to my district and say, oh yeah, there's only 33 fracture critical bridges. They could fall down, but we're okay. I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, just the last comment, that's just the unfortunate nature of the term fracture critical. It sounds inflammatory, and I know we've suffered a great tragedy in this state, but it is relatively rare that a bridge does collapse or partially collapse. That's just the terminology that's used to describe these bridges.
Representative O'Neill.
One follow-up. So when you send me the report, can you ease my mind, let me know that all the ones that were imminent to collapse have all been addressed and our bridges are safe? And I mean, I think that's really the point, that those most critical bridges were addressed.
Mr. Chair, I can do that. I can put together a summary along with the Chapter 152 report, and I think it'll be a little bit clearer to you then that how those high priority bridges have been addressed and how the ones that are remaining on the system are a lower risk bridge.
Okay. I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. And this is very important to get these terminology clear and reassure people. So with that, members, we're going to start to hear a few bills next week, and want to make sure everyone is aware of that. Look at the agendas. And with that, we're adjourned.